Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to talk to you about MIT Investment Management Company, also known as MITIMCO, the investment office of MIT. Each year, MITIMCO invests with a handful of new emerging managers who it believes can earn exceptional long-term returns in support of MIT's mission. In order to help the emerging manager community more broadly, they created emergingmanagers.org, a website for emerging manager stock pickers. For those looking to start a stock picking fund or those just looking to learn about how others have done it, I highly recommend this site. You'll find essays and interviews by successful emerging managers, service providers used by MIT's own fund managers, essays MITIMCO has written for emerging stock pickers, and more. MITIMCO also occasionally and opportunistically hires new members for their investment team. To view the job description, please visit mitimco.org/global-investor. That's mitimco.org/global-investor. The MITIMCO team spends their time learning about great businesses and investments, working with exceptional investors around the world in order to support generations of MIT innovators. Hey guys, it's Brandon from the Macro Ops Value Hive podcast. At Macro Ops, our aim is simple. We want to make high risk-adjusted returns consistently, continuously learn while doing so, and have a lot of fun along the way. And in this regard, our record speaks for itself. This is partly why we have by far the highest retention rates of any investing service in the industry. Collective members tend to stay members for a long time because there really is nothing else like us. We offer differentiated research, theory, and education resources, plus a killer Slack community filled with some of the smartest operators from around the world. Our members are predominantly professionals, but we also have a high number of highly motivated retail investors and traders. The one thing we all share is a deep love for the game of investing and an unquenchable thirst to get better. If this sounds like you, then consider signing up and checking us out. You simply go to macro-ops.com/collective. That's macro-ops/collective. This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional-level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally, with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. ValueHive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive. I'm back with another anonymous podcast, this one with Left Field Investing. And I'm going to refer to Left Field as just Left Field or Left. And, we'll let them stay anonymous. This is an interview that I wanted to do for a while. And I feel like I had to bully you a little bit, maybe not bully, but just like constantly DM you and say, hey, come on the podcast. Hey, come on the podcast. Hey, come on the podcast. Because I really like your work and I love your background. It's very unique. It's totally, against like what the standard is. Like, oh, I went to this, distinguished college, did 2 years at investment banking, went to Goldman, and then started diving in. It's, it's very, very different. And like, I prefer interviews like this. I prefer people like this. And I think we're going to have a lot of fun. So why don't we get some background on you, Left, for those that don't know you, for those that maybe haven't read your research, before we dive into all things investing.
Sure. Sounds good. Thanks for the invite. Yeah. I didn't feel that, I had a lot to offer. I guess your listeners, just because of that background, I'm going on my ninth year investing now, but it still feels like I don't really know a whole lot. So to get on a podcast and talk on a soapbox for an hour and a half felt I was a little apprehensive about it, but it's okay. And I appreciate the invite. So background with investing. I started in a weird place. My first exposure to markets, I opened a TD Ameritrade account, and it was like $150, and I think I was still in high school, and I bought like a share of SolarCity, and then I got bought out by Tesla the next, like within a week. So that gave me the bug, I suppose. For some reason, I stepped away for a while after that. And I don't know what spurred it or where I found it, but I was online and I was reading about this event that happened. It was called the DAO hack. It was made by a team called Slockit. I think they're German or something. And they were one of the earlier adopters to a project that was called Ethereum. And I just started paying attention to what was going on there. And basically, it was a terrible idea. But the project was essentially an investment committee where people took all the Ether they owned. They bought these things called DAO tokens. And then the project got rugged. Someone hacked it. And from there, I just started paying attention to Ethereum as a whole. And it kind of turned into like this sort of flows bet, because essentially what it looked like was being created back in 2016 was sort of like this global unregulated version of the stock market that had four stocks on it. So, you know, the whole idea was, you know, if flows grow by 2, 3, 4 magnitudes, all this money is going to be pointed at these like a few instruments. And that sort of seeded me with my first bit of money.
And so from there, you went and kind of parlayed these bets into Tesla, SolarEdge, and Enphase. Why those?
Well, from the SolarCity buyout, my attention already had kind of turned towards Tesla. So that had been on my radar for a while. And, you know, just growing up, Elon Musk had sort of rocketed into, like, you know, center stage as like a, I don't know, just like one of the premier billionaires or whatever, doing crazy stuff, running SpaceX and whatnot. So that was already like in like my field of view. Like, I was focusing on what was happening with electric vehicles. And we can sort of touch on some of the things there later. But with solar, you know, it was clear for a long time, and it has been clear since like the late 2010s, that the installed capacity, like just the number of panels that were being installed, the volume growth there was tremendous. But, you know, the panel manufacturing, that wasn't a good business. And so I was trying to pay attention to like parts of the tech stack that made sense to own that would go into utilities and just residential solar installations. And what came to mind was inverters. That they're one of, besides like batteries, they're one of the more expensive and like complicated parts that go into like assembling that, besides maybe, you know, like a maintenance crew or whatever, but that's like it's a different type of business.
Yeah.
What I started looking at were these microinverters, because there's two typical inverters you can have for a solar array. You can have a string inverter where on a rack installation you have, I don't know, say like 5 or 10 solar panels in a string. And the entire string will feed through that string inverter. And then you had these microinverters, which attach to each panel. So, you know, it tied the unit volumes together. And at the time, what I was paying attention to was Enphase was advertising a few different things. So there was a whole big deal with shading factor, where with like a conventional string inverter, you would limit the entire string if one of the panels was outputting a low amount of power. Mm-hmm. So that could be like a tree branch, or you know, it's like physically covered by something, or a cloud, or whatever. So I was that was a compelling argument for, you know, why these things might start to take share. And then there was some other things like, you know, if one of these fails, you know, if a string inverter took out an entire row of panels, you know, for considerations of like production, that was an interesting argument. And then just like troubleshooting and maintenance, mm-hmm. and sort of like the installation process that went along with it, and it just seemed like a decent bet to make at the time. I didn't buy at the bottom. It was sort of the summer of 2018. I think shares were trading around like $5.50 for $6 a share. And sort of Enphase had just like started to make its recovery. Because at the very end of that year, I think in the fourth quarter, they started you know, actually having earnings again. After sort of the company ran into some trouble. And you know, I wasn't really paying attention to these bets. I wasn't super zoomed in on like quarter to quarter. And you know, I just kind of let that stuff ride for a while. I try to be hands off with some of these things. You know, for a stock picker that might seem a little just more professional people that, you know, they're looking at net working capital every quarter and you know what changes where and when. But you know, it turned out okay. And that sort of got me hooked, because yeah.
When it sounded like, just from our, you know, kind of discussions and the outline you sent me, is those two positions were effectively some of the seed capital, which then jump-started your investing philosophy towards like nano caps and profitable micro caps. And I want you to discuss your like background, not even market related, but just like your upbringing and like how you came, you know, like where you came from, and just, you know, realizing that like your story is unique. And I want people to hear like that it's not just this cookie cutter, like, oh, my dad ran this wealth fund and he let me manage some money. Like, you were building this very slowly on your own and compounding your wealth to get to a stake now, where now you've got like a sizable stake that you can play in markets.
Yeah. So I'm probably the only person in my family that's even owned a stock, outside of, like a 401k or something, you know, single parent household. So there was no real exposure to, markets in any fashion. I guess you brought up microcaps. Sort of the inspiration there. There was a few places. Paul Andreola was a big one, who kind of made a name for himself on like Microcap Club and stuff like that. Because he was the first investor to publicly cover XPEL, back when it was, I don't know, it was like a 4 million Canadian market cap, and you know, it compounded over the next 15, 18 years into, I don't know where it's trading, like $3 billion or something, $2 billion. But you know, the whole motivation from there was, you know, there are real liquidity constraints, for the sizes, that some of these public businesses get to. You know, if you have, say you just have $10 million, which, you know, that's within the range of just someone that's pretty fairly well off. It's hard to go downstream to an $8 million nanocap and actually buy any of that and have it move the needle for you. You can do it if you want, but a lot of people aren't looking to do that. And that's doubly so true for fund managers and you know, professional capital that's active in the market. And yeah, it can't move the needle for them. So if you can find these things where, you know, there's a business intact where the cash flows are gonna you know, they're not just going to disappear on you. And, you know, you have some form of alignment where either the management team is distributing capital or in the form of like dividends or buybacks, you know, that money can accrue to you. And you know, that bet so far for me really in the last year and a half has been with Cypher Pharmaceuticals. It's this off patent acne medication company that's picked up a couple interesting licenses. And you know, for a while I was buying that company at like an enterprise to free cash flow yield of something in the neighborhood of like 40% to 50%. And you know, if you look at the portfolio, while there was some historical declines with the licensing revenue they had from their US brand because Absorica went off patent back in like 2015 or 2016 or something. And you know, that's sort of like the historical decline of that business, but they maintained that share up in Canada and it grew, and it's something like 60% of their business now. And you know, so if that trend just continued, it was obvious. It was one of the most obvious things I've bought in the last 5 years. You know, it didn't depend on any big macro trend in AI or solar or electric vehicles. You know, it was just $0.50 laying on the ground for 50 cents. You know, it was a lot easier and more reliable in my view. But yeah,
how did you find Cypher?
I was referred to by another investor I know. That's a lot of the discovery process, especially when you build up a network. You know, if you know like 500 or 1,000 people, you know, they're going to be pitching you ideas left and right. And, you know, you don't have enough time in the day to look at all of them. So, it was a friend that referred me to it. We were talking about, we interviewed Jeffrey Hisham of Ready Shred Capital back in, I think, late 2022. And I was interested in what he thought of the guy. That led us into our discussion about Cypher.
And so you start buying this company. Naturally, my thought goes to portfolio construction. And so you're hunting in these nano caps, micro caps. What does your portfolio look like? I mean, is it you spread your bets out? Are you hyper concentrated? And did that change over time from when you first started investing?
Yeah, I'm probably more concentrated than most people would be comfortable with.
Yeah.
I'm not tracking the weightings probably as closely as I should be. You know, if I was to guess right now between like a selection of four different equities, you know, it's like 60% of my entire portfolio, maybe more. So, you know, that's a lot of concentration for some people that, you know, more typically carry like 5% to 20% weight limits, you know, on positions. Yeah.
And so you're just buying with no clear, like, hey, I want to get this up to 20%. It's just, I want to buy as much as I can and be content with whatever the percentage is after that.
Yeah. And you know, the a lot of the time, because going back to like early 2023, you know, I was looking at like the existing, you know, like the financials that were already there and the money that's here today and that's coming into accruing shareholders, right? But you know, most of the time when I'm buying something, I'm always looking for some driver for like earnings per share growth that's a few years out that like I can have you know, some high degree of certainty of working. Cypher Pharmaceuticals specifically, that was a license they formed with a Swedish company called Moberg Pharma, who developed this topical for a condition called onychomycosis. It's a nail fungus. It's one of the more common conditions in the world. It's the estimates range, but it's between like 8% and 14% of the general population are infected with nail fungus, which is surprising.
Yeah.
It mostly infects older people, and the best drug on the market for it at the moment is a product owned by Bosch called Jublia. And a little over half of the patients that take that medication for a year experience mycological cure. So their infection is gone, and over time their nail will eventually return to being, you know, a somewhat normal looking nail.
Yeah.
Moberg sort of created this drug that improved on that by a lot by combining terbinafine with an old asset of theirs. I'm currently blanking on the name of, but it basically it just let it get into the nail a lot more effectively and a lot quicker. So, you know, Cipher Pharmaceuticals sort of going into like late 2023, they had an idea of for what this was going to do for them, but they never spelled it out for investors until they were required to do a valuation report for a significant issuer bid that they had Evans and Evans performed, just because it was a requirement to do the SIP. And essentially what they spelled out is that this asset specifically is going to make their business somewhere in the range of like 3 to 4 times larger by their estimates.
Yeah.
And that was sort of what I had in mind too. So, you know, it was, I had this margin of safety with this pre-existing dermatology business with this off-patent acne medication. And I had this growth driver and it made it an easy buy. And so like getting back to the point of like portfolio construction, you know, I was reasonably confident that this wasn't all going to fall apart. So I wasn't, you know, too concerned with if this was 20 or 30% or if the stock was up 5 or 10% in a day, you know, or down or whatever. So, yeah.
And when you're researching these pharmaceutical companies, like I've had a couple guys like Peter Mantis, who is, you know, someone that I consider is like one of the smarter life sciences pharma guys out there. I think a lot of these companies fly over the radar of generalist investors because you're dealing with, you know, drugs and patents and medical studies. And now I don't know if you have like a medical background per se, but like, how would you advise someone like myself that doesn't have that domain knowledge to, you know, get to a level where I can understand something like a Moberg or something like a Cipher beyond just saying, oh yes, they have cash flow?
Well, I mean, that's a great point to start. Cause right. You know, I haven't made any bets, contingent on, you know, some phase three that pops out well on a pre-revenue business. I can't do that.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, I don't have strong enough domain knowledge to be confident in some, speculative asset that's being produced. Like with here, with going all the way back, I think into 2020, it was early 2023. You know, the European Union had already approved Moberg's drug for them, so it was like, you know, and you know, this is a topical that just is going on your nail. There's not like a lot of risk with like something bad happening to a patient. So it was like, no, when this comes time to get a request for approval over here in the US and in Canada, you know, it didn't seem like the type of thing that, you know, I was going to get a zero on because regulatory bodies weren't happy with the safety or something like that. Other than that, it's just a lot of reading. And you know, it's also like risk management with like portfolio construction too, because you know the distribution of outcomes for pharma and biotech in general, it's so crazy that you can't push the risk limits on this stuff in general. But you know, like it's always company specific when you're investing in a specific stock. I'm not making a huge basket of pharma bets. I'm focused on this like one product that, you know, I was comfortable with the current yield, and I was comfortable with the asset that was coming. So I don't know that I have any advice specifically. Although you know, Peter Mantis, a lot of his focus on med tech and stuff like that, he's looking at sort of like the toll road for biotech and pharma, like with, you know, with like ClearPoint with neurodrugs, I think West Pharmaceuticals or
Did you ever do any work on ClearPoint?
I know quite a lot about ClearPoint.
Does that mean you own shares or no, or is that
I have a small current stake. And a lot of the early motivation was from the original AADC patients. What happened there was basically a miracle. They inserted a gene into a person's brain in a specific part of their brain, and they were essentially able to make these otherwise very sick people healthy again. And that's unique. Just because neuro and neurosurgery is like a very small niche, there's more hospitals in the US than board certified neurosurgeons. it seems like it's going to take a long time. I mean, AADC, Upstaza still isn't approved in the US, even though there's 10 years of human data there for that drug, and it's for a super rare disease, so you would think the FDA would move faster. But you know, we're slowly over time kind of seeing developments happen there. The latest one is with Neurona. They're looking at focal epilepsy, and they were able to reduce the frequency of seizures in these drug-resistant epilepsy cases by a lot. So that's like the last big development that's happened with ClearPoint. But you know, it's one of those slow movers that is just going to take time to, you know.
You mentioned the FDA. Do you think the FDA, like, what are your thoughts in terms of like headwinds versus tailwinds for the FDA? And do you run into issues with them where, you know, they're just either like too slow, or they're just missing the boat, and like there's money they're leaving on the table for a lot of these pharma companies that could be putting products out in the market?
Oh, sorry. You were breaking up there. I hope I wasn't interrupting. No, but it's kind of a good point, because a company I've covered, they're working with a partner called Medac. I believe they're a German company who own an asset called Triosulfan. And Triosulfan is it's used for bone marrow conditioning in individuals going under cell transplantation. This could be for like acute myeloid leukemia, myelodysplastic syndrome. It could be for CRISPR Therapeutics new gene editing treatment for sickle cell disease or beta thalassemia. You know, it's just like it's a general conditioning regimen for surgeries where they're implanting stem cells into a patient. And this drug has been used, I believe, under orphan designation in Europe since like 2004 or something, and it became the standard of care over there for for acute myeloid leukemia and some other conditions that they're trying to get approved over here. And you know, the survival rates for these conditions, it appears to be higher. And maybe more importantly, it's a lot easier to tolerate, because busulfan is the agent that we use over here in America, and it has a high degree of hepatotoxicity, where a condition that used to be called veno-occlusive disease can be created, and in a marginal percentage of these people that develop this, it becomes a fatal condition that leads to multi-organ failure. And the just some like retrospective studies on like deaths from these stem cell transplants, there's about 350-400 excess deaths in the U.S. Attributed to busulfan, because it causes veno-occlusive disease. Treosulfan improves upon this because it's not metabolized in the liver, and so the frequency of the side effect developing is a lot lower. And Medac has gone to the FDA twice now. They weren't rejected really on the premise of the efficacy of the drug. Their application was rejected on the contents inside of it. And so they're going for their third resubmission. And this is a process that's going to ultimately add another 5 years to the approval timeline for when this stuff first gets on the market. Yeah. And there's some other things I can get into, like busulfan has higher gonadal toxicity. So children that undergo with acute myeloid leukemia, which undergo stem cell transplantation, there's a risk of causing infertility there and everything else I said before. So, the FDA, it feels really bad because, I just look at this one example and it looks awful because, there's a whole bunch of excess people that are dying. Survival rates for acute myeloid leukemia would be higher, and you could lower some of these other toxicities. It's not my profession. I'm not working within this setting, so it's easy to critique as an investor that has exposure to some of these things or just like see these one-offs, but it can certainly be a big headwind because I don't think anyone has really expected treosulfan the last 5 years to get approval.
When you look at, let's say, you're being pitched a lot of ideas, I'm sure a handful of them are pharmaceutical companies. Is there an idea, maybe it's a pharma company, maybe it's not, that is kind of in the small cap space that is like a popular long idea that for whatever reason you think is not a good idea? And maybe pharma is a good example because it'll allow me to kind of see how you siphon out good versus bad in this space when comparing companies.
That's all we've talked about so far. I really don't look at a ton of med tech pharma companies. And it's not a small cap, and I don't even want to mention the name.
Yeah, that's fine.
There's a company that's trading, and they have a drug that's gonna work, but it's gonna work because it's essentially a vitamin they're making, and they're advertising it. It's a vitamin that helps treat a rare disease, and they're advertising as being eligible for a priority review voucher, which is essentially an incentive program created by the FDA to help encourage the development of rare drugs. And there's just no way they're going to get it. And these things sell for like $100 million, and it's like a $8 million company. And, you know, if you have the combination of, oh, this thing's going to work and we're eligible for it, you know, that's sort of like, that's a management team that's sort of baiting shareholders. I just can't own that thing. Just cause when someone shows you their teeth, as like potentially going to screw you over, that's a good sign. You should back out. It's on the blog. It's an older post. One of the better examples I saw with this was with PowerREIT, which is now a failing cannabis nanocap REIT. I think it got up to like $100 million, and now it's down to like $2 million. But going back to right around the time that company started collapsing, there was a filing with the SEC from a board member who was, I think she was, her name was Paula Poskin. And basically she had some complaints about their responsibilities to shareholders. Where you can go on to Edgar's and find this filing. But basically without saying it, she essentially accused that entire management team of fraud, and she subsequently stepped down. And now about 2 years later, the stock's like 98% lower.
I'm looking at the chart. It's honestly, it's unbelievable. It reached in 2022, it reached a high. And again, I don't know if this is adjusted for splits, but a high of $81.99. And it is now trading at 65 cents.
And there was a whole bunch of, we could do a whole 90 minutes on just PowerREIT and the fiasco there. But there was a whole bunch of related party transactions where the CEO of the company was sort of like self-dealing with himself, because he had he has two other companies. One of them is a failed cannabis company, which is, I think it trades for like $1,000 on the OTC. Like, it's literally zeroed. Basically he engineered the financials of that company to spike really hard by all these large upfront rent collections from himself. And then there were subsequent step downs on I think there were like 20-year leasebacks. So it's sort of sometimes, you know, things that are going to make me stray away. It's not always going to be like a valuation thing. A lot of the times it's going to be, I see something where someone's acting in an obviously bad way, that seems like, you know, I wouldn't want to be a partner in that,
yeah,
because that's essentially what you are as a shareholder with no recourse.
That's that story on PowerREIT. That maybe we do another podcast on it, because that is a chart for the ages. And it's funny because I just had Aaron Edelheit on the podcast to dive deep into cannabis again, because it's one of those bombed out spaces where some charts are starting to perk up, but that one does not look good.
No. Yeah, it's I've noticed the same thing. In specifically in nanocaps in cannabis, I'm aware of so far three companies that have, I mean, they've 10 bagged in the last 18 months. And there's just these little tiny cannabis companies where, you know, the hurdle for growing was going from a few $100,000 of revenue to $1 million, and some of them started turning a profit. So the stocks went up a lot.
So we've talked a lot about pharmaceuticals, and I want to spend kind of the next half of this podcast diving into GEO, which is the prison camp. I don't really know how else you call it. I mean, it's just a prison. Correctional facility, I guess, is a nicer way of saying it. Walk me through that whole thing, because I've seen the Shrub talk about it, who's, you know, a really good friend. and you know, another great anonymous podcast guest here. So like, what's the deal with the situation here?
So back in the summer of 2023, I was looking at this thing. It was around $7 a share. And, you know, as soon as I opened up the financials, it was clear there was really two business units here. There was the prisons that you're referring to. And they're okay. I don't think they really earn their cost of capital if you were to sell off the real estate, because they're just the assets are marked way lower than what market value it actually is. Then they're an okay business, but a while, I think it was like 7 years ago or something, they bought a company called BI Inc., which was originally formed to track cattle, which is going to make this sound so much worse.
it really is.
BI Inc. formed an agreement with Immigration and Customs Enforcement several years ago, where they were part of the Intensive Surveillance Appearance Program, or it's commonly referred to Alternatives to Detention. That segment has been growing for a while. It peaked in, I believe, 2022 with around 400,000 enrollments. Like the total number of enrollments peaked and like the amount of money that was being paid out. All the while, there was sort of like this upsurge, I guess, in crossings into the border and people sort of going through the asylum process in the United States. What became clear is, and this is data that is published by Immigration and Customs Enforcement on a website. There's actually a there's this really organized Excel file that it gives you all sorts of granular data, like on the amount of time that each of these individuals in each state are on the program. And you know, if you just look at Geo's financials, this is a business segment with like 56% net operating income margins, which is, it's a fantastic business. And so, you know, one of the first things I noticed, because ICE publishes this data, the time on which people have been staying on this program has been increasing, and it's gone up by a lot. I think the average is somewhere around like 550 days now. And that's just a function of going through the immigration process here in the US. There's only so many courts to sort of like make judgments on these people that are going through the asylum application. And so I was sort of paying attention to that. And then a bit later, this was thesis drift, because originally the idea was just, oh, they're just going to deleverage this and a debt pay down is going to get me, you know, a 20% return. And I was like, I'll take that. That's great. But then in the appropriations bill from the House of Representatives, there was a segment that said that they were going to maintain enrollment of the entire non-detained docket throughout a person's entire asylum process, which like set off alarm bells in my mind, because the entire non-detained docket has grown to, I think now it's upwards of 6 million people. And you know, there's only at that time there was only 250,000 people in ATD. So if they stick everyone into that program and they maintain it throughout the entire duration, you know, some of these people are getting notices to appear 5, 6, 7 years down the line. So it was like, wow, like they might just become a giant software company that's tracking all these people with like some huge multi-billion dollar contract with the government or something. It was like, that's wild. So that's sort of like what I begin to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's great, but you know, the funding needed to come from somewhere, because it hasn't been something that's like been pinned out or funded anywhere. So just recently, I think maybe 2 weeks ago, in that border bill that was rejected by, I think, the Senate, there was a bit that mentioned that they were going to increase the funding allotted to the ATD program to something like $1.3 billion over the next 2.5 years, which would, with the current funding, bring it to like $1 billion annual run rate, which would represent like three times growth. Obviously, that hasn't been passed yet, but this entire time, like, kind of like going through, you know, who like the movers and shakers are and who's like advocating for this stuff, this grew under Biden, the Biden administration, but the use of these tools was a bit more heavy-handed under Republicans with Donald Trump. GPS monitoring and like the ankles, ISAP program were much more prevalent then. It was basically everyone, and that made the program a little more expensive. It kind of seemed like this bipartisan program to sort of help with case management for these individuals going through the asylum process, and that was sort of the idea there. And you know, it is very true that like everyone that looks at Geo, they see a prison company, but yeah, like inside of it, there's this really high margin segment with decent revenue characteristics that make it something different. And you know, going into Biden's presidency, the thing that sent this thing from like 30 to 10 or 6, it was the elimination of the private prisons. But at the same time, you know, the ATD blossomed up, and if you go and look at their EBIT, it's been like a straight line from like 200 to 300 million over the course of his entire presidency. I mean, the only quarter it took a dip was last quarter, and that was driven by a reduction in the headcount of ATD, which in my view is driven by the length of enrollments inside of the program, because you know, mm-hmm. if people are in there for longer and the budget's allocated to said case, well, you can't fund everyone. Sorry, that was a bit of a rant, but yeah,
that's why I got John here, man, to pitch these ideas and to rant about them. I think Geo is an interesting one because it's such a polarizing idea, I guess, politically. And if I'm an investor too, like politics aside, and I pull up this name does not screen super well. So I see a company that has barely grown top line revenue since, call it 2017. Like in 2017, it was like 2.3 billion in revenue. And this year it's 2.4, at least, you know, kind of 2023's numbers. Now the operating income has gone from 235 to what looks like, I believe it's like as of 2023, 361. So there's definitely some operating income leverage there. But if I look at this and you pitch this to me and I say, okay, like this sounds great, but I look at the balance sheet, I see a lot of debt, 94 million in cash against, call it maybe 2 million in debt. Maybe that's leases on the prisons. I don't know. Like, what's the catalyst to change this entire narrative and to actually get this thing to re-rate to some sort of SaaS-like business with 50% margins? And then when will that even show up in the financials?
Just because it's attached to a prison company, I don't think you're ever going to get a giant re-rating. Because, you know, especially if you look at some market transactions for the real estate, you know, they have their prisons marked at like $22,000 a bed. But you know, if you look at some transactions between like CoreCivic and the state on similar real estate, you know, the market's at like 65 And if you look at new construction, like the replacement cost, it's like $300,000 a bed. So just like the asset value, it's not really earning something like the financials that the per diems and everything they're getting paid for actually running a private prison. It's a terrible ROA. So it's like 2-3%, maybe lower. So you know, that's not something that particularly deserves a high multiple. Originally my idea with this bet, it really was debt pay down, because
which they've done, it looks like they've paid down a ton of debt since 2014. I mean, they've paid down hundreds of millions a year.
Yeah. It seemed like the interest coverage ratio was healthy enough and that they would be able to meet some of their maturities. In the last, I forget exactly when it was, but the reason you see on some of like the later quarters where earnings dropped, that beyond ATD accounts dropping slightly, a lot of that was a function of they ran into a maturity wall, they refinanced at like really high cost debt, and I think like the blended average interest rate for their balance sheet, it's above 10%. So for a company where it seems like the cash flows are moderately secure against, you know, these government contracts, because you know the Biden administration already threatened to shut some of these locations down, and you know they're still up and running. It just seemed like they were going to be able to pay that off, and you know, 6 months ago when this was at seven a share, and you know, I pay down $300-400 million of debt, and my market cap's at 700. You know, if I just keep a enterprise value that's flat, you know, that's going to be a heck of a return. And that was the idea then. Really, the focus, if someone's looking at Geo now, it has to be around their alternatives detention contract they have with ICE and Border Patrol, because you know the enrollments, the incremental revenues there, that's what's going to drive those bottom line margins and like the ability to deleverage and stuff like that. And you know, there's other smaller things that you can look at, like you know, in 2024 they're sort of like British American Tobacco, where they're trying to get to a certain leverage ratio before they resume capital returns. And that's that, you know, that's another lever they're probably going to start pulling in at the end of 2024. I believe share buybacks. Historically, this company was a REIT, so it was paying out dividends. The reason they turned into a C corp was so they didn't have to pay out the dividends, so they could actually delever.
This, again, I might ask a couple dumb questions here, but if I look at this business and I see this prison with a lot of debt at 10%, and I see this high margin software business, 50-55%, you probably get where I'm going, but why not just spin off the really good business?
That would be awesome. I would love for them to do that.
Like, why haven't they? Like, is that almost like a mark against management in a way that they haven't done that yet?
Yeah. And probably, because this is like a mid cap, you know, that's one of the advantages I have with some of these smaller companies is I can actually like go and talk to these people or email them and they'll respond to me. You know, spinning off BI Inc, it seems like a pretty good idea, and they could probably even sell it. One thing with the multiple there is because it's contingent on contracts funded by government for like a specific application. Mm-hmm. It probably wouldn't be like a really like a multiple that you would, you know, see on like CrowdStrike or something where you get like 20 times your revenue or something. But you know, it's hard to say. if you look at it historically, for when that business unit really started moving the needle, it's hard to say the company ever got any credit for it. Just because before this was even really a thing, it traded at a higher multiple. And that's including balance sheet leverage. So, yeah.
To me, this just seems like I totally get the idea. This is just one of those where, like, part of me saying, just like, why buy now when you can wait for management to either do something that makes more sense, or you wait till they pay off their debt. But then the counter to that is, by the time that happens, like, what if the stock's already re-rated to, you know, $20-$25? Because that's priced in.
Yeah. No, it's always a question, right? There's probably something like 15,000 global securities to buy. Buying a specific one, it should always be compelling enough, and something you understand well enough to actually, you know, own it.
So we've talked pharmaceuticals, we've talked prison camps / former cattle detection service companies. What other stocks are you looking at? What other spaces have your interest as we wind down the podcast?
I mean, it's not going to be blow anyone away, but I'm a fan of Constellation Software.
No way. That's a very unique insight.
Mark Leonard, what his group did there was amazing. So I've sort of been paying attention to those spins, Lumine and Topicus. I guess if it's another pitch on a smaller company, an interesting transaction happened with a subsidiary of Topicus. Their TSS bought a controlling stake in a publicly traded company called Signity that's out in Poland. And it looks like basically what their intention is to turn it into another vertical market software roll-up. And this would be, this essentially makes Signity the first sort of Constellation related public microcap that's existed since, you know, Constellation itself was a smaller company back in like 2004. Yeah. So, you know, with those things, the product focus, it's harder. It's more like a jockey bet, sort of hoping they bring over their best practices. That's one I've been paying attention to. It's kind of newer on my radar.
And tell me about Left Field Investing and the newsletter and the whole writing process. I mean, it's been cool seeing the growth of this newsletter, and just wanted to pick your brain on kind of initial expectations and plans for the future and how this whole thing's unfolded for you.
Sure. The initial success of the amount of growth that I saw, especially once I began monetizing it, it wasn't something I expected at all. I don't know that I necessarily have a plan. Originally, I began monetizing it with the pitch surrounding Terclara, which was the asset Cipher has exposure to, mm-hmm. to sort of explain what was going on there. Just because I didn't see anyone talking about it. I don't know whether it's something like I'm going to maintain indefinitely into the future. And especially like writing pitches to an audience, it's different than, you know, forming these things for yourself. And you kind of, in a way, you take on a way different outlook and like risk tolerance than just when, you know, you're dealing with your own portfolio. Because in some ways it's like you're not really managing other people's money, but if I'm looking at this as like an outsider, what the intention is with a paid newsletter is, okay, you're going to provide me with information that helps me buy things that go up. And so it's like that is a hard thing to maintain. So I don't know if I have a plan. The growth has been phenomenal, and I've really appreciated the support I've seen so far. And you know, I've been pretty happy to see some of the outcomes from some of these things. But other than that, I don't really know.
That's why I wanted to get you on the podcast, because we would chat in DMs and I read some of your stuff, and I just wanted you to get in front of a larger audience because I think you provide a lot of value and you're very underfollowed. So that's just kind of like that, you know, general outlook. And you know, I just, if I can help you at all reach whatever goal that is, I mean, that was the whole point, is just to get you on, let people know, and you know, kind of just say like, hey, like this is a really smart guy on Twitter that you know, flies under the radar a lot, that's looking in places most people don't look. And so that's really why I was so glad that you decided to come on, because I know it was kind of a big step.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
So I've got a couple closing questions that I ask everybody. The first one, and again, just, you know, please plug your Substack or whatever, is where people can go to find out more about you. We obviously connected on Twitter/X. So if anybody wants to know where to find you, where can they go?
Yeah, my Substack is Left Field Investing, substack.com. It's not really a very readable handle on Twitter. I think it's Left Field at F_FHRS or something like that. I don't know. Left Field Investing at Substack.
Awesome. And then the last question, if you could have dinner with one person from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
That's a hard question.
And you can't say Buffett, please don't.
I don't think I would pick an investor at all. I would want to meet Nikola Tesla. That guy is just, yeah, is, I mean, something's going on up there.
Yeah, that'd be fascinating. I mean, just to be around in that, I mean, that era was Tesla, and just to, you know, I mean, I think, you know, in some ways, probably on a very smaller scale, right? Elon Musk, you know, we're living around when he's trying to send people to Mars. So that's pretty cool. But yeah, Tesla was definitely unique.
That's for sure. He ushered in the modern age of electricity.
Yeah. Yeah, we're still using Edison's grid today, which is probably saying less about us than we want.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Left Field, this was awesome. Let's do this again whenever you got another idea or whenever you hit some sort of milestone on the Substack. And best of luck the rest of this year. And thanks again for doing this. Like I said, this was a big leap, and I hope you get a lot of subs out of this. I hope you get more followers.
Okay. Thanks, Brandon. I appreciate it, man.
Right. Today's episode is also brought to you by Marhelm Data. Marhelm is an information service for investors to find real value in an overvalued market. With a focus on shipping and commodities, Marhelm helps you stay on the pulse of global trade, track global sentiment, and identify compelling global investment opportunities. ValueHive listeners can get 20% off a Marhelm data subscription by using the code VALUE at checkout. That's VALUE at checkout. Head on over to marhelm.com, marhelm.com to get your discount today.